Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm James Hattori, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. To make a good investment, you might need to battle your brain. How so, you ask? The new field of neuroeconomics is studying the brain as financial choices are made and finding that smart money decisions require resisting powerful emotions. Money magazine writer Jason Zweig is here to share the latest thinking and offer some tips. This hour on Point, Money on Your Mind. Joining me now from the NPR studios in New York is Jason Zweig, senior writer at Money Magazine. He also writes for Fortune and Time. He's the editor of the revised edition of The Intelligent Investor, and his new book is Your Money and Your Brain, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. Jason, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you, James.
Well, let's start with the big burning question. Why do smart people make dumb money decisions?
Well, it may be largely, James, because they are smart. You know, one of the biggest problems that investors have is what psychologists call overconfidence, thinking you know more than you really do. And in general, the smarter you are and the more you know, the more likely you are to think you know even more than you actually do. And that can lead people to take risks that are excessive in a bull market or even in a bear market to take fewer risks than they probably should.
I think I understand that, but I probably would otherwise. But let's talk about neuroeconomics. What is this, and what's it showing us about our thinking process?
Neuroeconomics, as you might guess from the name, is a hybrid between neuroscience, economics, and obviously there's a fair amount of psychology thrown in too. And essentially, this is a developing science that combines the tools and techniques developed in neuroscience labs, scanning and other techniques that measure brain activity, with the experimental techniques used by economists and psychologists to give us a feeling for what's going on in the brain as people make financial decisions.
Well, before we get into the specifics, let's talk a little bit about the news. What do you make of the frothy market this year? It's been going up and down in wild swings. How are people digesting it and reacting to it?
Well, James, I think that's a fascinating question, because I would bet you that if we were to ask most of our listeners, how has the stock market done this year, most people would say terribly. You know, it's really been a bad year. In fact, the market is up 6 to 8%, depending on how you measure it, for the year. Yet most people feel terrible about it because the ups and downs on a daily basis have been so violent. And the brain is not particularly good at interpreting proportions or percentages. So when we hear in the news, perhaps on NPR, that the stock market was down 200 points today, that's very alarming. What people tend to overlook is with the Dow Jones at somewhere around 13,000, you're actually talking about a change of less than 2%. And if most of the other variables in our lives changed less than 2%, we wouldn't be very concerned about it. So the key is to try to put things in long-term perspective. And some of the discoveries of neuroeconomics, I think, can help us understand how to do that better.
Does the same kind of thing apply to what we hear so much about, the subprime mortgage mess? What does neuroeconomics tell us about that?
Well, I think there what's happened is that so many people got carried away in housing, just the way investors got carried away in dot-com stocks, for example, at the end of the 1990s. And one of the problems is that the brain appears to interpret borrowing money as a kind of gain, so that the short-term kick you get from being able to buy a house with borrowed money, or for that matter, getting a check when the bank writes you the proceeds of the loan, is interpreted in your brain as an immediate reward, which really triggers the emotional centers of the brain. The pain of having to pay the debt back is something that occurs only in the future. It's abstract. It's vague. It's not processed very well by the brain in the present. So people got carried away by this trade-off between a very specific, immediate, pleasurable reward in the absolute now valued off against the pain they would incur from paying that debt back in the sometime future. And that's a trade-off that the brain isn't very good at making efficiently.
That sounds like past returns are no indication of future performance of a stock or an investment. You had your brain actually scanned physically. Tell us about that. What was that about, and what did you learn about yourself?
Well, yeah, in the course of when you write a book with a title like Your Money and Your Brain, it better be largely about your own money and your brain. And I participated firsthand in, probably 8 to 10 different neuroeconomics experiments. And they were designed to investigate a variety of things, the trade-off between the present and the future, how risk and reward are calculated, also the difference between expecting and experiencing either a gain or a loss.
You mean they actually looked at pictures of your brain at various points while these decisions and things were unfolding?
Absolutely. You know, with functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, which is a technique for viewing the patterns of blood flow within the brain, neuroeconomists can track how decisions are made over time. And this is the difference between essentially taking a snapshot within the brain and taking a movie of the brain. And it enabled them to make a motion picture of my brain in the process of making these financial decisions. And what I learned from it is that my brain works not much better and fortunately not much worse than most other people's brains. It's reasonably efficient at some things, but not particularly good at making trade-offs between risk and reward, present and future.
Well, elaborate a little bit about that. What about this greed and anticipation versus reward?
Well, one of the central findings, I think, that have emerged from neuroeconomics so far is that expectation and experience don't work quite the same way. When you expect to make money, that's a very intense and profoundly emotional experience. On the other hand, experiencing a profit tends not to be nearly as emotional as expecting it was. And that applies to the gains that you believed were coming. Now, if you make a surprise profit, that's a different story. But if I'm imagining that I'll make 15% on my mutual fund next year, imagining that gain will make me feel very happy. If it actually does go up 15%, I may end up rather dissatisfied with that, particularly if other people made even more. And the problem is that expecting it to be more intense than it actually turns out to be when you experience it tends to underlie a lot of the problems people have in believing that money will buy happiness. You always expect that it will because it feels as if it should. But in the end, it often doesn't, because you're comparing what you did get against what you could have gotten. And it's often a lot less satisfying in reality than it was when you imagined it.
Is fear, when you're talking about economic decisions, hardwired into the brain? How does that happen? And how does it affect our financial decisions?
Fear is profoundly hardwired into the brain. We are mammals, and just like all other living creatures, evolution equipped us to be afraid of things that are bad for us. And in the modern world, we happen to process the fear of financial loss much the same way that our ancestors would have processed the fear of wild animals. And a particular part of the brain called the amygdala, which is involved in processing fear, is activated when people imagine that they're going to lose money. And the amygdala is incredibly rapid in its responses. And this is one of the problems with conventional economic theory. Most economists would hold that when people are making a risky decision, they're making some kind of analytical cost-benefit calculation. If it goes well, I will make this, and if it goes poorly, I will lose that. But the evidence is that the amygdala responds to fearful stimuli in roughly 12 or 15 thousandths of a second, which is 20 or 25 times faster than you can blink your eye. And the notion that people can do a cost-benefit analysis in that length of time is ridiculous. If something is frightening to you, you've already made your decision by becoming afraid. And when the stock market crashes, or you merely see a stock market ticker on which all the symbols are red and all the arrows are pointing down, your body has made a decision because your stress hormones are surging through your bloodstream and your brain is sending an alarm signal throughout your body, and that will make you inclined toward rash decision-making unless you put policies and procedures in place in advance to control your impulses.
Policies and procedures? Give us a hint of that. We only have a few seconds left before we take a break, but what are you referring to?
Well, for example, if you are an individual investor, one simple strategy you could do is you could make a watch list of stocks that you would like to own if only they were cheaper. And then when the market crashes, let's say the stock market comes down 20%, check your watch list and you may find they are cheaper. And instead of panicking and selling, that would prompt you to buy.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how financial decisions filter through the brain and how our minds deal with risk and reward. Joining me today from the NPR studios in New York is Jason Zweig, senior writer at Money Magazine. His new book is Your Money and Your Brain, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. Jason, let me play for you a little bit of a sound that sort of capsulizes what a lot of people might experience from time to time. This is the NBC game show Deal or No Deal, which puts the financial brain under pressure. Here's contestant Jackie Monroe, who must choose whether to take the safe money or go for more. Host Howie Mandel puts her on the spot.
I'll ask you the question. You talk to your loved ones. Make a decision, Jackie Monroe. Deal or no deal?
There is so much left on the board. To leave with $38,000, although it's generous, Howie, would just be plain silly. It's too low. No deal.
Well, this is obviously a hyped-up, dramatized version of the thought processes that some of us may experience. But Jason, is it kind of accurate in a way?
Well, sure it is. And, you know, one of the reasons we find game shows like Deal or No Deal or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire so compelling is because they actually echo a lot of the decisions that we have to make in our financial lives. You know, you buy a stock, it goes up. Should you hold it and hope for a higher profit? Or should you lock in the sure gain and then become more conservative with the money you have left? Those are choices that investors make every day, whether they're professional or individuals. And over 30 years of research shows that people tend to be somewhat risk-averse when it comes to gains. If you have a gain, you may well tend to lock it in by selling that stock. Probably selling it too soon, in fact, because you're afraid that the gain you have made may disappear if you hold on to it longer. Conversely, when it comes to losses, people tend to be more risk-seeking, so that if you've lost money on a stock, you'd probably rather hold it than sell it on the belief that it might actually recover and the fact that you're loath to admit you made a mistake in the first place. So our preferences are inconsistent. We'll take one risk and we'll avoid another, even when the same amount of money is at stake.
Okay, let's add another voice to our conversation here from the front lines of neuroeconomic research. Joining us now from Falls Church, Virginia, is Kevin McCabe, professor of economics and director of the Center for Study of Neuroeconomics at George Mason University. Professor McCabe, welcome.
Oh, hi, James.
What's your take on this science? It's obviously still emerging, but is it at the point where we can really take something from it and affect our behavior and perhaps our pocketbooks?
Sure. I think what you have to realize is that neuroeconomics has only been around for about 10 years now, where economists and neuroscientists have really been having a conversation and engaging in joint research on economic problems. So I think you know, what we're learning right now is kind of the why part of what's going on in economic behavior. And I think that many of the things we used to say were important for investing or for decision-making are still the same, but we're getting a better handle on why that's true. And we're also now developing techniques that allow us to test new theories about how brain activity actually leads to decision-making, and that will go on, and that'll be an important contribution over time.
And just tell ourselves, buy low, sell high, buy low, sell high. does the processing of financial decisions change over time, Kevin? Does culture play a role, or gender even?
Well, I think what's important is to realize that one of the big things that neuroeconomics is finding out is that not everybody's the same. While we do a lot of mental processing, a lot of brain processing the same way, we also have different cognitive strategies. And some of those strategies seem to be gender-specific, although it's hard at this point to say too much about that because I think we're just learning something. Some of it seems to be culturally dependent. Some of it seems to be experience dependent. That is just how you develop, how the brain develops over your lifetime.
Okay, let's open up the conversation a little further and go to the callers. Rusty is on the line from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Rusty.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question for the speakers. I'm in real estate finance, and we're in quite a credit crunch now due to some, I think, some impulse-based decisions. Could you talk a little bit about the emotional and logical disconnect between something like, you know, finances and housing?
Well, yeah, sure. I'll jump in first. You know, neuroeconomics does tell us a fair amount about impulse, and I think there's no doubt that when people borrow money, particularly cheap money, and especially teaser money, in which a mortgage might have been offered to people with a low rate in the short term that jumps over the longer term, people have a hard time processing the total cost of that loan over the life of the loan. And the pleasure of moving into that beautiful big house is very immediate and very powerful and really hits the reward centers of the brain. The pain of having to pay that loan back in the long-term future is very abstract, particularly if complicated math is involved, in which a changing formula will have a differential impact on the value of the loan over time. So people grab the house with the cheap debt today and pay very little attention to the high impact on their finances in the long run. And that's one of the things that led to the real estate bubble. All bubbles over time are always driven by first by greed and then by leverage.
Let's go to Glenn, who's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, guys. I have a comment. I actually just turned you guys on the radio, and it's interesting, given the time of the year and just some of the things that are going on in my life, there's been a lot of fear. I heard one of you guys mention fear around some of the decisions that we've made over our lifetime as it relates to our finances. And mine specifically is geared toward a primary home that I have, and I actually landed the home for a very good price, and then I had a good rate when I refinanced it at 5.25% several years ago. And that mortgage is about $250K, but then I went with a HELOC on the home several years ago when the prices were, I guess the home values were increasing, and I got a nice chunk of change in that. And I've spent that money, it was about $240,000, I've spent $200 of that, and I have really nothing to show for that. And so I've ate the equity out of that. And I was just thinking about, you know, your fear comment and the decisions that you guys were talking about as we've made, or I should say as I've made along the way, and how that impacts, you know, this, or what that, you know, your guest thinks about that in terms of his book.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Thank you, rather, Glenn. Kevin, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, you go first, Kevin.
Sure. You know, I think one of the things that was already talked about on the show was the how present-minded we are in our decision-making, and that leads to us paying attention to things like immediate rewards. But I think that what you have to do if you don't want to encounter these kind of fearful moments in your life is to have a strategy. That is, you have to have a plan that you can follow, and one that anticipates the future and what you need in the future and so on, because our brains aren't actually that good at integrating the future into our current decision making.
Jason, you have to add on? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just add a couple points. I totally agree with Kevin. I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I think before you take out something like a home equity line of credit, you should look at the purposes that you would put the proceeds of the loan to. Maybe make a list of the things you'd like to spend the money on. And then show that list to someone who has no stake in your decision. And ideally, it might be a financial planner if you work with a financial advisor. Or if not, I would recommend the person you most respect in your life. It could be your high school science teacher. It could be anyone you've stayed in touch with over the years whom you really respect and admire for the quality of his or her decision making. And I would just show your little sheet of paper to this person or an email and just say, I'm going to borrow a couple hundred thousand on my house, or I'm thinking about doing that, and here's what I would do with the money. Does this seem like a good idea to you? And in fact, even just thinking about doing that might be enough to dissuade a lot of people from taking the loan out in the first place.
Let me ask you, is there something inherently dumb about taking a extremely risky proposition or a decision, making a decision that you know is going to be risky, but the potential rewards might be huge? Is that dumb?
I don't think that's
dumb. Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
I think that, in fact, you know, people should take some risk, but they've got to balance the risk they take against what they hope to get as a return, and also against, you know, what their current economic position is. You can't take big risks if you can't afford it. But in some sense, all of our lives involve a certain amount of risk taking. Everything from going to college and risking sort of what the job market will look like to everything else. I think it's just got to be managed risk.
Jason, let me ask you, what about rich people? Do they operate differently when they make financial decisions? Have they learned some of these lessons you've been talking about already?
Well, I guess what I would say, James, is that what a person's risk tolerance is a function of so many factors in that person's life and circumstances and situation that it's very hard to generalize. You know, some very wealthy people take enormous risks and very rash risks. Others are extremely conservative, and that may be a function of where they earned the money in the first place, whether they inherited it or whether they built it themselves through their hard work. It may also be a function of what needs they have for the money otherwise. What we do know is that people who are poor or feel deprived tend to be more conservative overall with their money because they don't really trust the system, perhaps rightly, but that when they do take risks, the financial risks they take tend to be pretty rash. And if you are lower middle class or below, you should really think twice about the kinds of risks you're taking, because you may get overly tempted by investments that sound like lotteries. And that's not a good way to build wealth in the long run.
Well, along that line, I think we have a caller, Ramona from Swainsboro, Georgia, on the line. Ramona, hi. What's your question?
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. My question is, I noticed the things that you're talking about is talking about people that have money, they buy houses, they have credit. You know, what about the people that have... just live paycheck by paycheck, or you know, get a paycheck once a week, every 2 weeks, once a month, and you get your paycheck, you're excited, you've got this money in your pocket. You're not excited about going to the grocery store and buying groceries that you need. You're excited about, oh, I need some clothes, I need to go buy a new TV, and you get excited about that. It makes you happy, makes you satisfied, but by the end of the month, you don't have enough money to eat on.
What about that, Jason?
Yeah, I'll go first. I'm sure Kevin has some thoughts on this too, Ramona. You know, one of the key things is that no matter how much money you have, how much money you lack, or how much money you want, you must, as Kevin mentioned earlier, have a plan. And having a plan is the single most powerful weapon any investor can have on your side. And one of the secrets, if you are someone who does live paycheck to paycheck, is, you know how on a, you know, in a restaurant, sometimes they say, you know, the food is not touched by human hands. What you really want is you want to set up a system where your money isn't touched by human hands. And if, for example, you work at a company that offers a 401k retirement plan, it would be very useful for you to participate in that plan, because then money will automatically be saved for you, and you don't have to write a check. You don't have to make a decision. A little bit will come out of each paycheck for you. If you don't have a 401k at work, you can set up an IRA. You can set up other savings plans on your own. And the key is to make them as automatic as possible. And ideally, you want a fixed amount of money taken out of your bank account every month that you don't have to take an active role in doing. And the more automatic you can make it, the better off you'll be. And you don't have to make it a large amount of money. You could make it a tiny amount of money. You could make it $50 a paycheck and see how that feels. Chances are you won't miss it, but 30 years from now, you'll be glad you set it aside every month.
Kevin, is that the way to sort of short-circuit the hard wiring in our brains that sort of tempts us to do the wrong thing? And are there other ways to do that same kind of corrective measures?
Well, I think Jason's right. You want to make it as automatic as possible, but also you want the money that you're saving to come off the top. And again, it doesn't have to be a lot of money. And then the other thing that's worth doing is about once every 6 months or so, look at your savings and look at what you're doing and realize that it's growing for you and that you're actually getting return. I think often people don't realize what their investments are doing for them because they don't look at that part of their economic lives.
Jason, maybe you can elaborate a little more on how we can work to change our hard wiring. Is it physically changing the wiring, or is it just taking tactics to, as I mentioned earlier, short circuit? And we just have a couple of seconds, so we'll come back and elaborate more. But
well, certainly what we can do is we can moderate our behavior, James. We can commit in advance to strategies and approaches that are helpful for us. And actually, in the December 24th issue of Fortune, I get into some of these. But the more you can do in advance, the less likely you are to be caught by surprise in the present.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori, and for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about why smart people make dumb financial choices. Joining us today from the NPR studios in New York is Jason Zweig, senior writer at Money Magazine. His new book is Your Money and Your Brain, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. And joining us from Falls Church, Virginia, is Kevin McCabe, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Neuroeconomics at George Mason University. And let's talk a little more, Kevin, about we mentioned the stock market and the wild swings that are going on right now. But first, let's take a listen to a bit of audio from CNBC's Mad Money, which, of course, features that zany host Jim Cramer, who always seems to be on adrenaline. Here he is yesterday in his lightning round, a call-in segment. He hits the bullish button for stocks that he likes.
Tell me about GameStop. How much steam does this baby
Monster
have left?
Monster stock! They doubted me. I took a lot of criticism every time it falls when I say back the truck up. But where did that stock go today? Where was it? It went to $60.96, up $2.81, and it is not done.
Kevin, you've done some actual studies on how people react when they're investing. Tell us about the science behind all that.
Sure. We did some research with Baylor Medical Center, and Terry Lorenz was lead author in that study. But we were looking at how people made stock market decisions. So we basically had them in the scanner where, for money, they were investing against historical stock market price sequences, like the Dow Jones or something like that. And then what we would do is basically show them a little bit of the market, have them decide how much money they wanted to put in the market and how much money they wanted to leave in cash, that is, keep safe. And then we would show them another piece of the market. Now, what we found, which was really interesting, is that if the market goes up and you don't have all your money in the market, you feel regret because here was money you could have made that you didn't make. So you actually process this kind of signal of opportunity cost or regret, if you like, as a signal in the brain that you should invest more so that you would end up chasing the prices up as they went up. Now, actually, when there's a lot of variability in the market, what we found is that that does cause people to become more conservative, and so they don't chase the prices as much. But when they get signals that their investments, that they could have invested more in the market and done better, then they overinvest, and they can easily get caught in traps of, you know, having too much money in the market, not accounting for their risk. And this is an area of the brain that's run by the dopamine system, which is a very goal-directed area of the brain. That is, it kind of, in a sense, forces us to follow certain goals that we're getting reinforced on, that we're thinking that we're doing well on.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Mike from Boston. Hi.
Hi. hello, everyone. Let me also say, Jason, this is Mike Ervolini from Cabot. How are you doing?
Oh, hi, Mike. How are you?
Good. Rather than the question, I was simply going to point out that I have been working in applying many of the concepts that are being discussed today to help professional investors. What we do is help the people who manage mutual funds make better decisions, because even the most disciplined and careful professional investors at the margins are susceptible to some of these highly behaviorally motivated decisions. And what we're able to do is help them in a quantitative way understand those factors and then manage them to get more performance out of the skills and knowledge that they bring to the process. And from our perspective, one of the things that wasn't discussed exactly as I'm going to say it is this, and that is so much of the decisions that everybody makes every day are completely formulated in the unconscious. And that's why many of us think that we can look back and say, oh, I made this decision for this reason or that decision for that reason. Oftentimes, as someone pointed out earlier, the decision is completely formulated in the unconscious and just bursts into the world as a complete thought. And unless you can capture those little decisions over time and analyze them, it's really hard for an individual or even a professional to understand whether they exhibit biases or exhibit some non-optimizing behavior. And so what we do is we just apply it. All the great ideas that are being talked about here, we apply them to help professionals become aware of these behavioral or neuroeconomic motivated decisions, and then to learn how to shift away from the ones that don't work and more towards the things that help them deliver better performance to their customers.
Mike, thank you. Jason, is that right? I mean, things come out of our subconscious that affect how we invest our money? I don't know.
Well, yes, James. You know, the term that most psychologists and I think neuroscientists would use today is the unconscious part of the brain, typically the emotional centers that are older in evolutionary terms. And I think Mike is raising a very interesting point. You know, in the investing business, as in most businesses, people who are professionals, experts, who have had many years of training and education in their specialty, tend to think that they are greatly superior to amateurs. We know it's true in sports, for example. But investing is a very peculiar area of human activity where being an expert means you are competing against other people who are at least as expert as you are. So you know you are highly trained and skilled, but it's a lot harder to perceive how much the other people are highly trained and skilled. And expert advice in investing does not necessarily lead to better returns. And I would argue one reason is because experts are human too, and their brains are prone to the same frailties as the brain of any amateur. And certainly if you listen to a show like Mad Money, you know, then you're listening to advice from the, I would say, from the fringes of abnormal psychology. So, you know, that's a clear example that, you know, not everybody in the money management business is sane.
Sure, and that Jim Cramer needs to talk a little louder, too. Let's take another call from Francisco in Salem, Massachusetts.
Hi, James. Thank you for taking my call. Are you listening?
We hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. I trade stocks online, and I read a book a couple of years ago. I don't remember the author, but he's a psychiatrist, and he trades regularly. And he basically, I think it's the name of the book is Trading for a Living, something like that. And he made very, very clear in his book, his emphasis on the book is basically that the markets are driven by fear and greed or ambition. And that your emphasis as an investor, more than technical knowledge, your emphasis must be in managing your fear, your levels of fear, and your levels of ambition. I've been trading for the last 4 years or so, and I'm noticing that he is so right. I think that investing is about managing your state of mind, is managing your emotions in any given moment. You will eventually know when to buy something, when to sell it. But more important than that, it's knowing where your mind is at that given moment.
Francisco,
I was just wondering what the panelists think about that.
Sure, just a quick question for you. Are you up or down in your investments overall?
Well, I'm on cash right now.
And oh, okay.
I have been up. Like I said, I think that the emphasis here must be on your state of mind, your emotional state. I think that happy people, positive people make good decisions and therefore make money. And I think that depressed people, basically emotionally driven people, make terrible mistakes.
Francisco, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Jason, what's your take on that?
Well, I think Francisco is absolutely right. The key to successful investing is controlling your emotion, not turning it off. I would argue that the greatest investors of all, people like Warren Buffett, for example, don't turn their emotions off. They turn them inside out. And, for example, they take the ambient emotion, the emotion that's in the air, and they take that as information. When most people are feeling afraid, a great investor like Buffett observes that, notices that. He might even feel an initial twinge of fear in himself. And he takes that as a signal that he should examine whether the emotion is valid rather than just surrender to it. And he has said many times that his goal is to feel fearful when other people are greedy and greedy when other people are fearful. And there's been an enormous amount of work done on the emotions of fear and greed in investing. And typically people who give in to fear at a time when markets are declining will suffer the consequences. And people who succumb to greed when the market is going straight up will get carried away, and both sides will suffer.
Kevin McCabe, let's talk about something that's kind of timely right now, especially this week. What should people be thinking about if you're out holiday shopping? And how does neuroscience inform that those decisions?
Well, it's kind of obvious advice, and neuroscience has a little bit to say about this. But basically, you have to put together a budget, figure out how much you can spend. You got to stay away from the credit card spending unless you're really, really good at managing, credit card payments and so on, which is another difficult area for people. Again, the problem becomes one of temptation, immediate temptation, because there's a lot of buying is a very rewarding activity against evaluating what you have to spend and realizing that any buying you do today is going to appear as a cost tomorrow for you.
Okay, let's go to a caller on the line, Deborah from Newport News, Virginia. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's interesting that your last guest was talking about the reward aspect of it, because that's what I wanted to comment and ask for input on. I'm an addictions counselor, and I'm delighted to hear that there is a whole science of neuroeconomics. I didn't know that before this show. I wanted to just comment that an earlier caller said, she has trouble, with saving the money for what it's needed for, that when she gets the paycheck, she wants to spend it on something that is exciting. In other words, that's immediately rewarding instead of delaying the gratification. And I find that in the people I work with and in my own life, too. If I don't build in some sort of more immediate reward, I don't get real excited about investments, the stuff that's going to pay off in, 20 or 30 years. I know it, intellectually I know it, and I do it, but it doesn't excite me. So I have to, give myself some more immediate things also, as well as the investments. And I'd like to hear some comments from your panelists on that.
Thanks,
yeah,
Deborah.
I'll jump in on that, if I may, James.
Sure.
I think one of the reasons that long-term saving is so difficult for people is because it's a very abstract goal. And, writing a book with a title like Your Money and Your Brain made me think a lot about how we can make the future feel more immediate and more emotional. And Deborah, I can totally relate to what you're saying, because over and over I've heard from investors over the years, well, retirement is so far away and that pair of shoes is right in front of me. Or, I really want the new Wii or, the latest Game Boy or whatever it might be. And that instant hit you get from spending money today is intensely emotional, and it hits straight into the reward system of the brain. And I think the key is something you may well work on with your addiction clients, is making the longer term consequences of actions feel more immediate. And I don't know what your dream for retirement is. For some people, it's something like a condo on the beach in Waikiki. And so instead of referring to your retirement plan with an ugly name like a 401k, you should probably start thinking of it as the condo in Waikiki fund, and you could put a date on it, maybe your 60th birthday, and you could decorate your account statements with pictures of palm trees and surfboards, and anything you can do to make the long-term future seem more immediate and more present will help motivate you for that long-term goal.
Okay, let's take one quick last call. Kevin from Attleboro, Massachusetts, quickly, what's your question?
Hello, James. Would your guest address the issue of gambling, specifically state lotteries? We know people will spend all kinds of money they shouldn't spend for that immediate gratification, even though the odds are 80 million to one. Is it the same dynamic? Is it a different factor altogether?
Thank you, Kevin. Kevin McCabe, you've done studies on this. We've only got about a minute. If you can capsulize it for us, we'd appreciate it.
Sure, real quick. Gambling is, again, one of these intensely expectational rewarding activities. That is, when you gamble, you expect to get a reward. Usually the benefits are very small from gambling. The risks are very high. I think what our last caller also mentioned is very important, and that is you should reward yourself as often as you can to prevent yourself from doing something. So if you find yourself wanting to gamble, find a way to reward yourself to not gamble. That is, when you don't gamble, give yourself some kind of reward, because it's that kind of reinforcement learning that helps you develop new goals and new behaviors, and I think that's really important.
Instead of a lottery ticket, maybe a cookie.
Exactly.
Kevin McCabe, professor of economics, George Mason University. Jason Zweig, senior writer of Money Magazine. Thank you, gentlemen, for the enlightening comments. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website. That is www.onpointradio.org. That's been an interesting program. I'm James Satori, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.